This is part two of the first talk of the weekend retreat, Unknowing the Self. Recorder kicked out, so I'm going to pick up, I think, where they left off. When I say I think, it is at times not me who thinks, but something else, speaking through my mouth. A desire to be liked, accepted, to fit in, or to be special, or a fear of appearing different or bothersome or contrary. When this life does not go as we expected, isn't our first impulse to fix the life, but rather than look at the source of our expectations? Perhaps this comes from our sense of me as the center of the universe. Do you have that feeling sometimes, that I'm the center of the universe? It is a natural assumption. After all, don't all our experiences seem to confirm our central place in this life? We know what is wrong, or we have a pretty good idea of what's wrong, and begin a project to make it right. Just as when our car or computer is not working right, we turn to fixing it. We try to fix the brokenness of our life in the same way. An inner critical voice, and we certainly all have that, in an effort to be helpful, no doubt, informs us how to fix what's wrong with a list of shoulds and shouldn'ts. We set out to remake our inner self, one that through the fruits of our actions will become strong, will perceive clearly, and be free of the confusion of daily life. And if what we try isn't effective, we try something else. The inner work becomes another project, just like all our other projects. We may study diligently, assume various attitudes, and begin to take up physical disciplines to create a life or identity that will be the right one. Yet, our Zen ancestors taught that this is just an illusion. It is an illusion trying to create another illusion to feed itself. Study and discipline are not bad. We benefit from studying Dharma and practicing regularly. But Nanchuan warns us to go beyond the project. Caught up in knowing our life, knowing ourselves, we lose something precious. The way is not about knowing or unknowing. When you know something, you are deluded. And when you don't know, you are just empty-headed. To reside in confusion is not it. To attain some state or knowledge is not it. Yet, there is another reason that our usual attempts to fix our life, to fix ourself, are problematic. They simply don't work. After some relief, perhaps, we hurt again. We do not understand why. The familiar sadness, fear, and longings grip our life. Our sense of isolation and separation seem as strong as ever. And although we want to feel compassion for all beings, to help all who come to us, our own problems are just too demanding and our lives too busy, and so we fall short. More ammunition for the critic inside. This practice of everyday Zen is not a simple or easy practice, although it appears to be so perhaps on the outside. It's not easy because it requires us to turn around from our usual way of being, our usual way of seeing and understanding both the world and ourselves. Everyday Zen is not about becoming. It is about unbecoming. It is not about knowing, but of unknowing. This unknowing is the heart of our practice, and I believe at the heart of most of the world's spiritual traditions. The self that we know, the one that looks back at us in the mirror every morning, is broken and incomplete. Perhaps we can make some adjustments, polish rough edges, and make it more presentable to the world. But in everyday Zen practice, we unknow the self. A letting go of the many stories we tell ourselves about who we are and open to a spaciousness and inner intimate life. Unknowing is to drop the surety of should and shouldn't, the surety of I am this, I am not that, and rest in the present moment without expectation, without judgment. We drop the I questions. When will I get enlightened? Why do I have this pain? Why do I have this restlessness? How do I keep a warm and open feeling? Or how do I get it back? How do I make my life work? These are questions that arise from our assumed truth of being separate, being broken, and needing fixing. They are questions of time's passage, of comparison, evaluation. Instead, bring forward questions of what and who that bring us into the present moment. What is this? Who hears this? Who feels this discomfort? Our questioning now focuses on the assumptions we have about ourselves. Unknowing our life, we shift the heart towards an increased willingness to receive the present moment in its fullness, its sensuality, without interpretation, indulgence, or avoidance. Unknowing our life, we open to the possibilities of the moment. Unknowing our life is to step out of the assumed reality of me and into a spaciousness that transforms. How do we let go? How do we let go of the self that, for example, can't draw a picture, the self that is never kind enough, the self that doesn't have the right body, the self that is not as good as the older sister, the older brother? How do we let go of the self who always knows better, the self that is frequently angry, the self that blames others, the self that is always late, the self that is spiritual? How do we let go of the self that needs fixing? How do we step from these boundaries, from shoulds and shouldn'ts, and simply be? The everyday Zen practice, in a nutshell, is to meet the world without trying to define ourselves. Unknowing means there is no one inside we need to defend, support, criticize, or fix. We can open the door when we hear knocking and see what the world has brought. Let me read you one more koan. Again, it's a very famous one. Maybe many of you have heard it before. This is from the Book of Equanimity, Case 20. Again, to Chinese Zen guys talking to each other. One is Master Dizhong, who is the resident at a temple in Fayan, who, as we'll see, is visiting. Master Dizhong asked Fayan, "Where have you come from?" "I pilgrimage aimlessly," replied Fayan. "And what is the purpose of your pilgrimage?" asked Dizhong. "I don't know," replied Fayan. "Not knowing is the most intimate," remarked Dizhong. At that, Fayan experienced great enlightenment. It seems like in all these great koans, so many monks achieve enlightenment. That not knowing, as Dizhong says, is most intimate. Most intimate because there are no walls, no barriers, no labels, nothing limiting. Ultimately, there is no you and that, no you and him and her. Just a sense of curiosity without grasping. The world constantly calls to us. We just have to show up. Suzuki Roshi puts it like this. In the beginner's mind, there is no thought, "I have attained something." All self-centered thoughts limit our vast mind. When we have no thought of achievement, no thought of self, we are true beginners. Then we can really learn something. The beginner's mind is the mind of compassion. When our mind is compassionate, it is boundless. Dogen Zenji, the founder of our school, always emphasized how important it is to resume our boundless original mind. Then we are always true to ourselves, in sympathy with all beings, and can actually practice. According to Suzuki Roshi, beginner's mind, or the not knowing mind, is the one of compassion. And how could this not be? A genuine experience of emptiness, of boundlessness, is accompanied by limitless compassion for all beings. Insight into emptiness is the insight of the interdependence of all beings, and we feel their pain as our pain, their joy as our joy. Entering into beginner's mind, into the mind that doesn't know, brings the arising of deep compassion for others. The mind that is not already made up, not filled with opinions and views and judgments, is ready for whatever experience arises in this moment. It is open to possibilities. When you know something, you are deluded, Dijong said. Deluded because your knowing is always limited. Our life and the world are bigger than any thought we have about them. How big is this life? How big is this life? In the Genjo Koan, Dogen Zenji gives us a clue. And he writes, for example, when we sail a boat into the ocean beyond sight of land, and when our eyes scan the horizon in the four directions, the ocean looks circular and does not look any other way. But the ocean is neither round nor square. Its features are infinite in variety. To us, as far as our eyes can see, it looks circular and does not look any other way. All the myriad things are like this. Within the dusty world and beyond, there are innumerable aspects and characteristics. We only see and grasp as far as the power of our eye of study and practice can see. When we listen to the reality of myriad things, we must know that there are inexhaustible characteristics in either an ocean or mountains, and there are many other worlds in the four directions. Whatever we experience, whatever we imagine, is not quite right. It is always incomplete. And how could it be otherwise in this limited body, but an endless universe? Our stories about life might contain some truths, of course, but the stories are just stories and not life, and they are not complete. At times in our life, we sail into the vast ocean and look at the circular horizon. Whichever way we look, all seems to be visible, to be knowable, and we assume this is the truth, this is the way it is. But the true horizon, Dogen says, is far greater, far beyond what we can see. Its features are infinite in variety. In our everyday Zen practice, we step out of the assumed reality of me and inquire endlessly into the inexhaustible characteristics of oceans and mountains of this life. I'd like to close this talk with a quote from Wendell Berry, a farmer, philosopher, poet, and a great writer. And he wrote this. This is from a section, I think I titled it, of one of his essays called The Real Work. It might be that when we no longer know what to do, we have come to our real work. and that when we no longer know which way to go, we have come to our real journey. The mind that is not baffled is not employed. The impeded stream is the one that sings. Well, thank you very much for listening.